This program are those of the host and the participants.
Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you from Campbell Hall on the University of Illinois campus. Our guest today is Katrina VandenHeuvel, the editor of The Nation magazine. She's a frequent commentator in American politics on CNBC, CNN, and MSNBC, and she writes frequently about American and Russian politics. Her articles have appeared in many places, including The Washington Post, LA Times, and New York Times. She's the co-author of and editor of many books, including the newly released book, Taking Back America and Taking Down the Radical Right, which she co-edited with Robert L. Borisage. Thank you very much for joining us, Katrina VandenHeuvel.
Thank you, Bob, for having me on.
Well, it's really a pleasure to have you on. As many of our faithful listeners know, Katrina has been a guest on the show before, and we want to talk about your new book that you've done with Bob Borisage. But first, for the sake of listeners maybe not familiar with The Nation magazine, and I think there are probably some who are not, let's talk a little bit about The Nation as you are its editor. What is the history of The Nation?
The Nation was founded in 1865. It's the oldest continuously published weekly. It was founded by abolitionists committed to the abolition of slavery in this country. And it has had a long and independent tradition. It is true to many of its core themes in terms of opposition to a militarized foreign policy, a commitment to civil rights and civil liberties, and a belief in an independent media as essential for our democracy. It's also, I hope, not to be too serious, but it's a troublemaking, agitating, muckraking publication with some terrific contributors, including, I think, your co-author in a number of occasions, John Nichols, who is our Washington correspondent, and Katha Pollitt, and Bill Greider, who just, you know, a few weeks ago around the time of Reagan's death wrote a terrific piece for us based on his experiences having done that famous interview with David Stockman, Reagan's manager of the budget, who revealed what a Trojan horse Reagan's economic policies were.
And how would you describe The Nation's politics today for someone unfamiliar with The Nation?
I think in terms of the political landscape we live in, The Nation is certainly left of it's left, it's liberal, it's progressive, but it's also a publication for concerned citizens of all kinds.
Mm-hmm.
It's a believer in many of the core values of progressive politics, whether it's fairness and social justice and equality, and multilateral foreign policy, and understanding that militarism doesn't bring democracy to regions in this world. So it's and also one of our core themes, and I come back to you again, Bob, and John Nichols, has been the importance of taking on the consolidation of media in a country which has too few views and choices, and the danger of living with a kind of downsized politics of excluded alternatives. And I would say that is a mandate and a mission for the magazine, to fight that kind of downsized politics.
Now, The Nation, if I understand it, is really going through a booming circulation phase at this point. Is it at its all-time high now?
It's at its all-time high. It was fun, perverse in a way, to see the Wall Street Journal recognize that on its cover a few weeks ago. We are now at about 170,000 in terms of circulation, and in 2001 it was about 100,000. And
that's astonishing.
I think it's wonderful, and I think it's a measure, I hope, not only of people's disgust for the most extremist administration of our lifetime. I think it's also a feeling that the news people getting, has been so timid and cowardly in these last few years, at a time when we need bold and courageous reporting. So I take great hope and heart, and I think, as a former editor of The Nation, Kerry McWilliams, a great editor, said, it's really a matter of getting The Nation into people's consciousness, people learning about it, and when they start reading it, they really understand it's kind of a light, a lantern in the dark.
How does the Nation is at
www.thenation.com.
Thenation.com. And so people can go check it out there, and many of the articles are posted there, though not all. So you have to be a subscriber and support the magazine if you want everything.
That's right. But we go to the web, we also have quite a bit of activism on the web. We, for example, launched 33,000 letters to the Judiciary Committee about a year ago in opposition to one of Bush's crazy nominees, but we have, you know, David Corn, who's written a terrific book, The Lies of George W. Bush.
No, we've had David as a guest on the show.
He has a blog, a regular blog, and John does, and I write one, and we have some great postings, dispatches from, you know, movements and protests, and it's worth visiting.
So, yeah, you don't have to pay any money. You can go and get a lot of good stuff at thenation.com and learn all about the magazine. I think it's fair to say that, well, just one last thing on the circulation. There are conservative magazines of political opinion, American Spectator, for example, Weekly Standard. How do they compare National Review in terms of circulation to The Nation?
We have now beat out the National Review. The National Review is at 155. The Spectator, you know, I don't know where it's at. As you know, I mean, the guy who really put the Spectator on the map, for your listeners who may not follow this internecine magazine politics, was David Brock, who's sort of angry, sensationalized exposés of Bill Clinton's sex life drove that circulation way up. But he now, as some of your listeners may not know, I think runs something called Media Matters, which is about exposing right-wing media.
We've threatened to sue him since that's the name of our show. But in fact, David Brock has been a guest on the show just a few weeks ago talking about his new book, The Republican Noise Machine, and his new group, Media Matters for America. So again, our listeners are up to speed on yet another reference you're making, Katrina.
I wanted to say one last thing because
sure.
I think it's important, because these are both times of opportunity. I know we'll talk a little bit about it, but also bleak times. And I think one of the roles of The Nation, and one of the roles of people who may be listening to your program, but committed citizens who believe in, you know, fulfilling the promise of America and its democracy, is that The Nation, you know, has always taken seriously the power of ideas, of conviction, of conscience, and as founded by abolitionists, that is our mandate, but also of fighting for causes lost and found. And I think, you know, we got to see the long trajectory of history. And without sounding too grand, this is a moment where it's really about building, and it's about seeing that there is, you know, there is a future for what we may now think are lost causes, but find their moment in history.
Ian, I'd like to talk about your new book, Taking Back America and Taking Down the Radical Right, which you co-edited and wrote the introduction along with Robert Borisosh. But let's just, before we get into the book, let's talk about the point you're just getting at, sort of the moment we're in, because to many people, especially those who would regard themselves as liberal or progressive or on the political left, but not exclusively by any means, there's a sense that we're in a very deep and profound crisis. But, I mean, what is the, in your view, how serious is this crisis? Are we in a situation where it's just like it was in the 70s or in the 80s or some other period, the 20s, and we'll almost certainly muddle through? Or are we maybe in a qualitatively different state where, as someone like Chalmers Johnson argues, you know, he can see the actual end of constitutional rule in this country, that is now for the first time in his life or in American history, a plausible end game to the path we're on?
Well, I mean, certainly in these last weeks, I'm sure Chalmers talked about how we've seen a kind of, you know, legal regime set up to justify torture. That is frightening to see an executive consider himself above the law and direct his minions to construct these legal justifications and directives. I think we're at a dangerous time, but it's also a moment of opportunity. Just as Chalmers Johnson talks about the possibility of, for example, gutting the rule of law, I think of the towns and cities across this country, the unprecedented outpouring of local opposition to the assault on our civil liberties, Bob. I mean, maybe you've talked about this on your program, but I think it's now over 300 cities, towns, counties, and states have passed resolutions against the Patriot Act. I think that there's a waking up of people in this country, despite the kind of wall-to-wall media disinformation that we too often see, particularly at moments like the Reagan funeral, where there's just no critical voice to be heard on TV where so many citizens get their news from. It's a dangerous time. The years after the end of the Cold War, we can dispute who ended the Cold War, were squandered in many ways, and we now come into this moment, as we wrote about in one of our recent issues, where the war, and I don't like to call it war on terror, has chilled so much of our democratic discourse and has undermined so many of our laws. But at the same time, I do think you have people waking up and fighting through the barriers, whether it's through internet organizing, whether it's through this outpouring of opposition to the Patriot Act, whether it's through what you're involved with, Bob, which is the beginnings of a media and democracy movement where you see citizens roused to send millions of petitions to the Federal Communications Commission. So I try to keep that balance. I do think that we need to understand the peril of another 4 years of the Bush administration, because look at what this administration has done with no mandate. And that's what we need to fight for in these next few months. And of course, and this is part of what my book goes toward, yes, there are many people, and I know we are two of them, who feel that the Kerry platform, if one can call it that, is not bold enough for the times we're in. But we got to hold two visions in our mind. There's the long-term building of a movement. But in the short term, this is the worst government the country's ever had. And the danger of another 4 years of that has to keep us motivated.
We're talking to Katrina VandenHeuvel today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580 from Urbana, Illinois. Today's program is pre-recorded shortly before going on air, so please don't try to call in today and make a phone call for the question or comment. Allow Katrina and me to do the speaking today on your behalf. And we are talking about Katrina's new book that she co-edited with Robert Borisage, Taking Back America and Taking Down the Radical Right, as well as her work at The Nation magazine, where she is the editor and has served as the editor for 10 years?
Almost 10 years. It's hard to believe. I feel it, though. No, but I mean, these have been extraordinary times. I edited The Nation anthology of 1865 to 2000, and of course there have been other extraordinary periods in this country's history and the world's history, but, you know, I've been editor, I think, all, you know, the war, the 9/11, the Iraq War, during the selection of the president. I mean, those events, just one of those, it seems to me, is momentous in its own.
No, you definitely have had several defining, career-defining moments for an editor.
But it's part of why I think, you know, we talked earlier about the nation's circulation. Certainly, Mr. Bush has played a role, just as Mr. Reagan did in his years when the circulation did go up. But it's also a very very politicized period. I think there's a politics to everything. I really do, from music to food to our electoral system. But there's a reason people are reading political magazines in greater numbers, because of these times when people need to have some sense. It seems to me The Nation is well suited, you know, to kind of interpret and explain some of what we're living through.
How would you compare George W. Bush to Ronald Reagan, a comparison that's made often both by George W. Bush and by critics of George W. Bush? How would you stack the two?
Let me just speak to something I know a little bit about, because I've spent so much time in Russia, Bob, and I got to know Gorbachev. And I just say that because it seems to me that in the way, and if you think about the period of discussion of, you know, when he passed away, when Reagan passed away, it was always about how he, quote, ended the Cold War. It was sort of what they were left with, his acolytes, because you can't really talk about how he left us with crippling deficits. Yes, one can talk about his optimism and all of this, but there was a disconnect from reality Reagan had that I see this president also having. On the other hand, when it came to working with Gorbachev, then the leader of the Soviet Union, to Reagan's credit, he was able to overcome his neocons, jettison them, people like Cheney and Wolfowitz, who said you can't deal with this Stalin and Gucci shoes, and overcome his own history of right-wing dogmatism, and he was able to respond to Gorbachev. Now, I would argue that no Gorbachev, no end of the Cold War. I mean, it's been lunacy what we've heard in these last weeks about how Reagan ended the evil empire. If there hadn't been Gorbachev's new thinking about the need to end the arms race in order to have political reform at home in Russia, you wouldn't have had an end to the Cold War, nor would you have had an end to Soviet control of Eastern Europe.
Well, so do you think George W. Bush is more or less...
Oh, I think he's unable to transcend the dogma. I think he is unable to do, you know, as I said, when the neocons of that era turned against Reagan, mm-hmm. he stopped listening to their advice. It was late. I mean, you had a period where there was a military buildup, a missile buildup, which threatened a kind of showdown with the Soviet Union, but he ceased listening to their advice and decided to negotiate disarmament treaties. And he had someone to partner with. Reagan always said it takes two to tango, and Gorbachev was the leader of that tango. But George W. Bush is unable to, he is the prisoner of these neocons because he doesn't have the political will. He is a prisoner of his ideology.
And I think it's safe to say that The Nation magazine, as well as your new book, Taking Back America, are both opponents of George W. Bush and neoconservatism and greatly concerned with seeing that he be a one-term president. Is that a fair statement?
That is a very fair statement, but I'd have to add that, you know, what's so interesting about this period, it seems to me, Bob, is that The Nation is in good company. I mean, we may not share the values of Richard Clark.
The terrorist expert.
Or General Zinni. Mm-hmm. But I mean, when General Zinni said on 60 Minutes a few weeks ago that, you know, George Bush is insane to say we must stay the course, that this administration's course is, quote, headed over Niagara Falls and the administration is clueless and dangerous, we are, you know, in sync now with a slew of people who we may not share values with on all kinds of things. So we're not the only one. I think there are many people, including people like Zbigniew Brzezinski, who played a role in arming the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, as Chalmers Johnson well knows, who's now talking about Bush as a messianic militarist.
What do you think that, now we're speaking here in the early summer of 2004, the election is, 5 months away, approximately, 4 or 5 months away. Any sense now, I mean, how this thing is breaking? What does your instinct tell you?
Well, I'll tell you, what's so hard is that there's so much news, as you know, that, you know, it's almost overwhelming to pick up the papers. This is a kind of lead into your trying to answer your question. So you have the horrors of Abu Ghraib. You have the horrors of understanding that this administration essentially issued directives in order to construct interrogations of torture. You then have 911 commission. You then have Reagan's death. You then have, the Iraq war, of course, going on, the whole issue of trying to end the occupation. John Kerry and the presidential campaign hasn't been able to surface this week. I think in the last few days, Bob, I mean, you know, he hasn't even made the newspaper, essentially. So core themes, his campaign is being obscured. At the same time, the Washington Post a few weeks ago had a cover story showing that the economy, which allegedly is recovering, which is allegedly, isn't working for Bush because people distrust, are anxious about Iraq. He's flailing about. So the question of the Kerry campaign strategy, which is not to be too bold, but to make this election a referendum on a failed presidency, that is George W. Bush's, at the moment, seems to be working. I think Karl Rove, Bush's right-wing guru, and again, back to Reagan, you know, Lee Atwater, that GOP operative was clearly a teacher to Rove. I don't think Rove has unpacked his medicine bag of dirty tricks yet, but, you know, who knows?
I think that's a safe statement. Yeah, so pretty much
it's too early.
It's way too early.
It's way too early. But, you know, again, we should be, if we were real polling political mavens of that kind, we would be discussing the 15 to 16 states in play because that's where this election's going to break.
Mm-hmm. Now, this book, Taking Back America, you co-edited it with Robert Borisaj.
Right.
Who's Bob Borisaj?
Oh, Bob Borisaj, he is, I think he's one of the great master political strategists. He is the co-director of the Campaign for America's Future, which is essentially a kind of political advocacy group set up to counter the corporate-driven Democratic Leadership Council, representing what I think Paul Wellstone and others described as the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party, has strong ties to the labor movement, has now convened three terrific conferences. This book we co-edited emerged from the one in 2003 when some 2,000-plus progressive thinkers and activists from across the country gathered in Washington to share ideas and strategies. But he's worked for Jesse Jackson on his campaign, and as so many smart progressive strategists, activists still in our political scene, they emerged from that campaign. We're doing a piece, by the way, on the 20th anniversary of the Rainbow Coalition and looking at what emerged from that for the Democratic Party.
Who's writing that piece?
Joanne Wipajewski.
Oh, okay, excellent.
Yeah, she's been interviewing people like Borisage, obviously Jesse Jackson, and Steve Cobble, political strategist, yeah.
We're talking to Katrina Vandenhoevel today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Katrina is the editor of The Nation magazine, and she's also the co-editor with Bob Borisage of Taking Back America and Taking Down the Radical Right, a brand new book just published by Nation Books. You guys are becoming a conglomerate over there.
Well, we have Radio Nation. It's no competition with you, but yeah, no, we have Nation Books has been doing very well, publishing about 25 titles this year.
Have you got a rap album out yet?
We're thinking about it. there is one out, isn't there, Bob? What is it, Rock Against Bush?
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing to me. I have someone working on a piece about all the Bush books.
Mm-hmm.
He can't keep up. And it's not just books. It's paraphernalia. I'm looking, as I sit here at my desk, at something I think Ben Cohen of True Maturity sent out, where, you know, you stick up a little Bush doll and he has his pants on fire. So liar, liar, pants on fire.
Oh, God.
I think they're buttons and bumper stickers. I think they're even thongs. I don't even want to go there.
Yeah,
but it's really,
yeah.
It's unbelievable.
So in this book, we've got, it's several sections. What's the basic idea behind the book when you put it together?
The basic idea was about offering a kind of, I'd say, strategic agenda to counter the right wing. And it's about laying out how Bush's policies have ravaged our country, laying that out. But then, more important in my view, laying out how Bush and the right are out of tune with the majority of Americans, how in area after area Americans prefer core progressive alternatives to the failed policies of the conservative right, and what it will take, what kinds of policies it will take to build an America that we believe in. But the piece of the book that I find valuable is how to build an independent capacity, a political independent capacity to reach out to citizens, to mobilize allies, to identify, recruit, train, and support the next generation of leaders. I think it's an interesting time to think about that. If I, you know, in these last weeks, and, you know, Reagan's death was a moment for what Gore Vidal called the United States of America to become what he called the United States of amnesia. But one thing that was valuable, when you could find it, was the discussion of how Reagan was the product and leader of a political movement. And it is true that he was the kind of champion of the New Right movement, which was created by Paul Weyrich and Viguerie and the, you know, the Christian Coalition. But it was about what we found useful in this book was to look at the right, to take a page from the playbook of the right, not their values, but to identify how one could build an independent capacity to push the Democratic Party, to push our politics and values into a different arena and into the political debate.
Well, this, of course, is a really central issue that liberals, progressives, left, whatever category you want to use, have been having through both our lifetimes, really, but especially, I'd say, in the last 20 years. With sort of the Democratic Party becoming a more business-oriented and conservative party than it had been in the New Deal era. And, you know, so how responsive can the Democratic Party be? I know this is a debate that The Nation magazine has been having for years as well, the relationship of liberals and progressives to the Democratic Party. And this came up in 2000 and again this year with regard to third-party efforts.
Right.
And Ralph Nader's campaign as a Green candidate in 2000 and now his possible campaign as a third-party candidate in 2004. How has your thinking personally evolved over the last few years in this issue?
Here's my thinking. I think that the Democratic Party has moved to the center in ways that are, you know, disturbing to those of us progressives, true liberals. And I think part of this book is to take back the Democratic Party, and part of that is about taking back America. We need to build this independent capacity. Our whole needs to be, you know, if our whole is going to equal the sum of our parts, we need to build this kind of infrastructure. The question of third parties has arisen this year in a very difficult way because Ralph Nader, someone who's written for The Nation for many years, who wrote one of his first major pieces in 1959, is one of the great icons of our political landscape as a consumer crusader. We believe in more views and choices in our political system. The whole issue of third parties in America is really riddled with difficulty. And I, you know, wrote a piece a few months ago called End the Two-Party Duopoly. And part of that was saying, in this year, the stakes are too high for Ralph Nader to be running. What he says is valuable. Wish he wasn't saying it as a candidate. And what we need to do is build the ability for a third party to run a presidential campaign down the line so that it's not a spoiler party. And we need to build up all of these mechanisms. You know what they are, Bob. I mean, instant runoff voting, proportional representation, fusion, which is allowed in seven states, including New York. One of the bright lights of New York state politics is the Working Families Party, which emerged in some ways from the idea of the new party.
Yeah, why don't you explain that? Because I think a lot of our listeners are probably unfamiliar with fusion and how that works.
Well, it's the ability to, you know, for a minor party to nominate, can enter alliances with major ones on the ballot. It's plural nomination. It permits minor party supporters to vote their values without wasting their votes. Now, it exists in seven states. The Supreme Court, in its lack of wisdom, denied the new party the ability to become a national fusion party about 10 years ago. But until we have these reforms of our system, at the national level, third parties are very particularly difficult in years where the stakes are high. Now, there are, as some of your listeners may know, there are many races around the country which are nonpartisan, and I think that the Green Party, to talk about Nader's former party, you know, has had success in local races at the state level. But at the national level, until these reforms are implemented, it's going to be very tough. So that's where I'm at, just in a realistic mode. I think what Dennis Kucinich did, wish he'd had more traction, but the running within the Democratic Party, listen, I mean, I don't see a lot of difference between Kucinich and Nader. I think Kucinich was out on the war issue way before Ralph Nader was, but for a lot of reasons, you know, he didn't get much traction.
Yeah, well, so you're not a fan of Ralph Nader running for president in 2004.
I'm a fan of Ralph Nader's.
Yeah.
I am, and I'm a fan of Ralph's. I am not a fan of Ralph Nader running in a year when the defeat of George W. Bush, who's led us into an illegal preemptive war, who's waging war at home on constituencies this magazine cares about, whether it's labor, whether it's women, whether it's the larger issue, you know, the issue of the environment. I just think it's a year in which it will divide.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I do think progressives have learned a lesson. Progressives, liberals who opposed Ralph in 2000, John Kerry, by, you know, meeting with Ralph, that's a gesture. I admit it's only a gesture, but it's a better gesture than what happened in 2000 when there was an effort to demonize Ralph by Gore and the people around him. There's a savviness now. I'm sure some of your listeners may have received internet mailings from a group that was set up by Howard Dean's communications director and someone who worked for Edwards, I think, but they're trying to woo back those who voted for Nader in 2004. And, of course, Nader now, in a funny way, not a funny way, in a tragic way, has found an issue, which he came late to, I will say, but he has found an issue in the war because Kerry has not moved himself to lay out a responsible, coherent exit strategy.
You know, we talk a lot about the Democrats and third parties, but a party that gets less attention is the Republican Party. And it's sort of, you know, you were talking about Richard Clark and General Zinni, and there are other conservatives as well, or self-identified mainstream or Republican types, who oppose this administration. Yet it seems like there hasn't been much dissidence that's really risen to the top in the Republican Party.
It's a fascinating question, Bob. We did a piece a few weeks ago about the dissension within conservative ranks with some terrific interviews with people you might expect, like Kevin Phillips, who's moved in an independent direction since being the architect of the Southern strategy for Nixon, but people who worked for Reagan, people who worked for Bush Sr., who think this is not a conservative administration. Preemptive war is a rejection of 50 years of a kind of bipartisan conservative foreign policy of containment. Running up these deficits, we now learn, has a legacy, obviously, coming out of Reagan, but the kind of excessive deficits, all of these things have moved a number of core conservative thinkers to speak out. Of course, there are the libertarian streaks, and then, of course, you have the Pat Buchanans, who has on his magazine a few weeks ago, the cover of his magazine, American Conservative, an interview with Ralph Nader, because one of Ralph's arguments, and I'm sure you've heard it, is that he can woo disgruntled conservatives and independents. Hard to see, because I think his anti-corporate message is so powerful. Maybe that Buchanan wing, but not traditional conservatives. He may woo some independents, but the danger there is that independent group is very volatile this year. A lot of it is trending Democratic. And if he picks up a lot of votes there, then you could really see, I think, eating into the possibility of a Kerry victory. But the dissension is fascinating. I mean, I wouldn't call them truth-tellers in the traditional way, but we have had Republicans coming to Congress. Richard Clark was one. Ambassador Joe Wilson, a longtime Republican Foreign Service person.
Scott Ritter.
Scott Ritter. Zinni, to mention another. General Shinseki, who hasn't been heard from. These are people who see in the neoconservatives a radical kind of neo-Trotskyist operation and not a conservative.
Now, we have a lot of listeners who probably are not immersed in sort of left history, and Trotskyism is like the War of the Roses to anyone under the age of...
You know what? I know. I'm trying to think. It's just that they're far more in tune with a kind of a radical right-wing agenda and not the traditional measured conservatives. And by the way, again, Reagan, his legacy here was to drive the party to the right, where moderate Republicans are a virtually extinct species in the Republican Party today.
You know, you say that, and I think that's true. If one looks at the Republican Party of the 1960s or 70s, a significant percentage, by no means a majority, but a significant percentage are people who today would be considered certain liberals on most issues, in some cases even extreme liberals, like a Lowell Weicker, for example.
Exactly. Or Jacob Javits.
Yeah.
Now, again, there was a regional quality to that, some of that, and we've seen, with all due respect, because I think within the red states, there's a lot of blue statism, but you see a kind of the right-wing southern streak of the Republican Party dominating. It's now the party of delay, of Lott, even though he was sort of symbolically repudiated, and not the party of Lowell Weicker or Rockefeller or even Barry Goldwater. I mean, Barry Goldwater in his later years was appalled, I think, by the extremism of some of the Republicans I mentioned.
Yeah, but, you know, and this goes to some of the points in your book that you were talking about earlier, where polling surveys show that a significant percentage of Americans, in many cases majorities, even significant majorities, are quite liberal on core social, political, economic issues. I mean, if you were to, depending on how you ask the question, but they're not lining up in support of the neoconservative policy agenda that's being pushed by the Bush administration, yet they are in power, yet it looks like they... may win an election in the fall, despite the fact that the issues are not popular that they're pursuing, according to polling data. How do we explain that?
I think it's partly what's happened to the nature of our political system. It's the media, to some extent, Bob. I mean, you followed this where, you know, I would never, you know, I've said this, I think, that to blame people for the lack of a progressive politics in this country, to blame people as its starting point is dead on arrival. But I think people are too often misinformed and in some cases deceived. We don't have a full marketplace of ideas in the media where most people get their news from. Journalists are not asking the tough questions. We saw that in the run-up to war. We now have had a media replete with mea culpas in these last weeks as people say we should have been asking tougher questions. We shouldn't have just accepted the administration's line. We have a money system. We have a system awash in money and special interests so that the kind of alliance building that was needed is now replaced by feeding this special interest base. So I do think the money, and I know for many Americans, when they hear about campaign finance reform, their eyes, you know, the my eyes glaze over happens, but it is a reason why we don't have any real reform in our healthcare system, why we don't have an increase in minimum wage. You just, you know, it's special interest pouring money into a system where you have a big pharmaceutical industry which has more lobbyists than representatives.
Well, I can tell an anecdote along those lines. So someone who's on the inside told me that when Nader met with Kerry in the meeting you talked about just a few minutes ago, Nader was pressing Kerry on a number of domestic issues to take a more progressive stance, and apparently Kerry, just in a moment of candor, said, look, I agree with you. I'm getting all my money from these industries. I really can't challenge them right now.
Well, there you have it, and I would just add one more anecdote, which Bill Greider wrote about for us. Howard Dean, let us not leave Howard Dean as a mere footnote in this election. I really think he showed the need for Democrats to stand up and have a spine and not be Bush light. And he spoke well on media consolidation issues too, Bob, as I'm sure you know. And he used the Internet effectively. I still, without being too rosy about it, have hope mm-hmm. for the Internet as a tool to break down big money to hold media and politicians accountable. He met with Bob Rubin, who is the Treasury Secretary in the Clinton administration, about a year ago. And Rubin said to him, well, you're going to, you know, change some of your trade policies because I can't trot you out on Wall Street. And Dean said, I'll get back to you. But, you know, why do we have some of the trade policies we have? Why is there such a grip of a kind of watered down but still free trade mantra in the Democratic Party? Because of a lot of it's the organized money versus organized people.
Yeah, the classic line. We're talking to Katrina VandenHeuvel today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Katrina VandenHeuvel is the editor of The Nation magazine. We've been talking about The Nation quite a bit this hour. And you can learn more about The Nation if you're not a subscriber at www.thenation.com, where all sorts of articles and blogs and pieces are available at no charge. Katrina VandenHeuvel is also the co-editor of the new book with Bob Borisage called Taking Back America and Taking Down the Radical Right, dealing with a lot of the issues we've been talking about in this hour. And if you're interested in getting a weekly email update on who our guests are with links to their books and articles and other background information on them, you can just send an email to our producer, Victor Picard. That's at vpicard, V-P-I-C-K-A-R-D, at uiuc.edu. We'll put you on our email list. You only get one email a week. You won't get any other junk mail. You can get off whenever you want. But it's a way to stay on top of all the shows we have coming up and getting links to our guests. You don't have to write anything down while you're listening to the show. Katrina, I would say, I think it's safe to say that The Nation magazine has been singular in its opposition to the war in Iraq from the very beginning, that it's taken a committed, outspoken, critical stance towards the administration's aims in Iraq from January 20th, 2001, when Bush came into office. And I think history, as the famous saying goes, has absolved you in your criticism. What is your sense now of what's, you know, here we are entering the turnover of power to the Iraqis. How do you think the war looks right now historically, if we could get some distance? And where do you think, what sort of outcomes could possibly come of this war in Iraq?
I think the war has been a disaster for this country, disaster for the world. Our indictment, as you said, we were there early. Our indictment had many counts from this administration misrepresenting the threat posed by Iraq, to the miscalculation of human and financial costs, to the shredding of international relationships, to what we now see, the gutting of international law, the gutting of our moral possibilities in the international community. We have believed in the possibilities of the United Nations. I think it's a very difficult moment because the UN, maybe because of its need to be relevant, has, I think, whitewashed the U.S. occupation of Iraq in this last period. What I think is crucial now, and the role we continue to play, is to argue for, as I said earlier, a kind of coherent exit strategy from Iraq. In the U.S., Bob, and here again talking about the disconnect between the kind of elite and the people, many of the most recent polls find that, 60% of Americans think we've gotten bogged down in Iraq. Majority believes unseating Hussein was not worth the mounting cost in blood and money. But, for the sake of the nation's credibility and the untenable security situation, the mounting U.S. and Iraqi deaths and casualties, and of the worldwide crisis of any confidence in the U.S. with the torture scandals, with this reckless unilateralism, we've called for a withdrawal in the next 6 to 8 months, because occupation by its very nature breeds instability. And we countered in our most recent editorial the arguments put out by well-meaning people about consigning Iraq to civil war, take issue with that. People should come and read our editorial, but we're doing much more harm than good by remaining an occupying force.
You know, and much of the arguments about the war in Iraq have been linked to the war on terrorism. It's always been sort of a strange marriage between the war on against Saddam Hussein and the war on terrorism. What do you think?
I don't need to quote The Nation. I can quote, you know, a kind of very centrist think tank in London, the Institute for Strategic Studies, or people like Anthony Cordesman, who are very centrist Republicans, who talk about how the war in Iraq has been a recruiting tool for al-Qaeda and has fueled danger in the world. The war in Iraq was never part of this fight against terrorism. It became the battleground because the administration made it the battleground, and we are now faced with the brutality of that. I mean, I don't know about your listeners, but I weep when I see the deaths every day of men and women of all ages, all races across this country. Last night there was a National Guard officer who was 51 in New Jersey. Then there was a young soldier, 21. Today there are pictures in our papers of National Guard people who are forced up out of reserve because this administration, in its incompetence, put aside its lack of morality, has stretched the military so thin that we have essentially a back channel draft, as you know. And you see this National Guard guy just hugging his daughter as they're sitting on the ground in New Jersey before he's shipped out, and you say, why are we there? Why are we there? I mean, so it's, and I just foresee more instability, more deaths in Iraq until there's the withdrawal of the U.S. forces, which so many Iraqis now see as occupiers, not liberators.
Do you think there's any chance that the Bush administration, either prior to January 2005 or if Bush is reelected or elected in the second administration, would remove the troops and remove all U.S. bases from Iraq and leave the country entirely, if so requested by an Iraqi government?
I think this handover of sovereignty is a real sham. I mean, they've found an Iraqi government, with all due respect to the good people of Iraq, which is, these people are most of them. These are people, you know, the Prime Minister of Iraq had longtime ties to the CIA. These are people who are clients of the United States. I think a Bush administration, if elected, would cut its losses in a cynical way, but would retain the bases. I think the bases and the claim on oil, I think the control of Iraq in certain important ways would remain a key component of a Bush administration in its first legal term if it wins. So it's a real danger. And of course, America is so isolated in the world. And you know, the danger, I think, Bob, is at the moment, and we've written about this, the rest of the world has made the distinction, I think, between anti-Americanism and anti-Bushism. Mm-hmm. If Bush is elected, I think that distinction will blur, because many good-meaning, well-meaning people in the world will wonder, what is going on in America that with all the evidence and all the failure, all the horrors, that this country would still elect a man who presided over this failed presidency?
You know, on the note, I mean, one thing that people outside the United States have asked me in my conversation, so they noted that Bill Clinton had been impeached for lying, or his transgressions around lying about a relationship with an intern, Monica Lewinsky. And then they look at the Bush administration admitting basically that the core evidence it gave to justify an invasion was a lie, was wrong, and was significant evidence that it was a conscious lie, that it was well understood that it wasn't the case, looking at the evidence provided by people like Richard Clark. Yet there's no talk of impeaching this administration, and what would seem to the casual observer or even the studied observer to be vastly greater crimes. Why is that?
Good question. There is talk of impeachment, but it's among a small circle of people. I think that it would reach a broader mass of people, certainly now, in these last weeks, what with the revelations of directives from on high about allowing torture as a means of interrogation, or clearly revealed a lying. But I think there is a view on the part of those who might well launch such a campaign in Congress, and those of us outside who might push for it, that the best method of impeachment is democratic regime change in 2004. If this was not 2003, you know, June, it was a different period, it might well reach a more critical mass. But I think people also worry, well-meaning people who want to get rid of this administration, that impeachment, because of its cynical misuse by the right wing, left a lot of Americans impeachment fatigued, you know, there was a kind of... So to bring that up might worsen the possibilities of what we want to affect.
Coming up later this summer will be the two national political conventions for the Democrats and the Republicans. The Democrats first in July in Boston, and then in early September, I believe, or late August?
It's late August. August 30th, September 2.
Okay, late August, early September in New York City, the Republican National Convention. And I think prior to 9/11/2001, the idea that the Republicans would center their national convention in Manhattan would have been far-fetched, as that is sort of seen as hostile territory to the Republican Party. Yet the plan was to have it in New York and have it as close to the 9/11 anniversary as possible. What do you think that convention is going to be like this year?
Well, they're doing everything they can in this city, Bob, to kind of, you know, police it, keep it heavy security, control it. The big battle at the moment is why the Great Lawn in Central Park, of course it has beautiful grass, but why that cannot be used for a peaceful rally, as many groups, United for Peace and Justice and others, have petitioned for the use of it. That is in limbo. But one hopes, and I think all of the groups coming to New York understand, that you have an administration which has exploited fear and exploited the fears of Americans to push through, ram through its agenda. I sometimes think that this administration has nothing to fear but the end of fear itself, and it campaigns on that. But that if groups engage in violence, the backlash which this Republican convention may, you know, may use for its own purposes, that there's hope that that will be avoided, that there will be peaceful marches, people bringing their issues to the fore and using the GOP and its cynicism. You know, this administration has so shortchanged New York in fundamental ways, from housing to education to the whole issue of homeland security, a term I don't like, that we did a cover story a few months ago called Bush to New York, Drop Dead, picking up on the board, you know. So I think, let's hope it's a peaceful, effective, rousing, fun protest against the cynicism and, you know, the cynicism and extremism of this administration. I think, as I said earlier, any violence will be exploited and there will be a backlash.
What part of town is the convention being held in?
In Madison Square Garden, which is, you know, it's the center of town.
Yeah, 33rd Street and 7th.
33rd and 7th.
Yeah, so right in the heart, like lower midtown.
Right in the heart of Manhattan.
Yeah.
It's about 2 miles from the World Trade Centers where they were, and you know, but there's not great, you know, when the administration put it here, they thought they could use 9/11, exploit it, but with the 9/11 commission hearings and a belief on the part of even many of the families, and not even the most political families of those victims of 9/11, feeling this administration has done too little and has squandered the real fight against terrorism by going to war against Iraq. There's a lot of ill will on the part of a wide range of people, and not just those who protest this administration for its policies.
You know, you spoke earlier about the power of ideas and how that drove the nation, the idea that you could argue and convince and debate and have a dialogue and change the way people think and the importance of that. Just this summer, a new film is coming out with a tremendous amount of publicity and a good deal of controversy, Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11. Do you think a film like that can actually tangibly affect the political process?
I do. I do. And I think, by the way, we've seen the books. Again, the film will have more reach, but there's scores of books, many of them on the bestseller list, and not only by Michael Moore, not only by Joe Connison or David Corin, our Washington editor, but by Richard Clark and Woodward and Joe Wilson. But those books have an impact. The film, I think, will have an enormous impact. They will do everything, they being the administration, its spokespeople, its minions, Fox TV, to demonize Michael Moore. But I'm looking forward to seeing it soon. But I've heard it's one of his most effective, most disciplined, most coherent and films, partly because he has, with all due respect, he's not as major a figure in it as some of his other films. So he lets the footage show. The footage has its own power. The interviews with others have their own power. And I think he just hangs these people, Bush and his people, on the basis of some careful editing of what they said. Just as, by the way, people, some of your listeners may not know of Robert Greenwald, who's done two terrific films.
Katrina? He has been a guest on the show.
Great. Well, his film, one was unprecedented, right, about the selection of 2000, but the other one, exposing the administration's determination, ruthless drive to war against all evidence and odds, was very effective in just using their words to expose them for what they are.
And this coming out this July of 2004, Robert Greenwald has a new film called Outfoxed, which is a critique of the Fox News Channel. So that I think our listeners will be well aware of that as it develops. Katrina, we've only got a few seconds left, and the last question I'd like to ask you is, as you look around the horizon of American politics today, are there any elected officials that really impress you as people of particular stature and integrity and vision that you know, our listeners could sort of look to? Because, you know, there's so much despondency about the lack of leadership.
Sure.
Who is it that gets you excited?
I would just ask people to go and find out about the Progressive Caucus in the House. There are terrific people in there, from Congressman Sherrod Brown in Ohio, Jim McGovern in Massachusetts, Dennis Kucinich was part of that. Barack Obama, who's running for Senate in Illinois, is terrific. Bert Cohen, who's running for Senate in New Hampshire, so smart and so progressive, terrific values. These are people who give me hope. Jan Schakowsky is someone else.
Another Illinoisan?
Another Illinoisan, and someone who's in our book, Taking Back America.
She's even on the cover.
She speaks with great conviction. She speaks as someone who was a former organizer.
Well, on that note, I'm afraid, Katrina Vandenhoevel, I want to thank you very much for being our guest today in Media Matters. Katrina Vandenhoevel is the editor of The Nation magazine, co-editor of the brand new book, Taking Back America. Again, thank you very much, Katrina.
Thank you, Bob.
Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Sugar Creek Symphony and Song, an opera and classical music festival in Watseka, Illinois, August 6th through 8th, featuring Gounod's tragic opera Romeo and Juliet. More information at sugarcreekfestival.org.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, mostly cloudy with scattered sprinkles, the high in the upper 70s with west winds around 5 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms, the low in the upper 50s with northwest winds around 5 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers in the morning, decreasing in the afternoon, the high in the upper 70s with southwest winds around 10 miles per hour in the morning, shifting to the northwest in the afternoon. You're listening to WILL Urbana, made possible by the support of our listeners, the friends of WILL. It's 2 p.m. Central Time. A Prairie Home Companion is next.